Okay, so we're going to do this a little bit different since we than the last group, because we figured essentials for a cryo-EM lab is pretty broad and everyone has different opinions. And so Yifan, we all talked together and made one presentation, and I think we can each give our own opinion, and we want discussion from the audience on this. So the questions that we were given to address: what do you need, what can you borrow, and how do you assess a new specimen? And in general, we wanted to start off with kind of general advice, philosophy of how you deal with negotiating your startup funds. And you want to be reasonable, because you actually can, if you are so unreasonable, they can withdraw your offer. And I've heard that happen. I don't know if we're cryo-EM people, but I've heard that actually happening before. You're so much of a pain, they don't, even before you get there, they're like, good thing we didn't hire them. But this is the appropriate time to ask for what you need and by exactly that. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to do your work. So what can be very helpful is to decide what's essential and what you can compromise on. And I think for me, that shook out into three different things. Things that you absolutely have to have or you can't do your work, and those you need to buy for yourself. Some of the things that are necessary for your work, but you don't have to use it every day, or that's pretty common, then you can share with people, as long as you make it very clear that you can share, and the people that you're going to share with know that the chair is telling them someone else is going to share their equipment. And then if there's things that are just nice to have but you don't really need, then you can usually borrow those kind of things.
The only thing that I would add, especially on the point, if you're going to be using a core facility that already exists and you're going to be using microscopes that other people are maintaining, I would be very careful about negotiating exactly what your role is going to be in maintaining the microscopes, and in making sure that they're performing to the level that you need, because I think a lot of times our requirements are sort of higher than if they're material science people using the microscopes, or they're different anyway than the material scientists or people doing a lot of sectioning work and things. So, and it's something that you might not think about. You just, oh, there's a microscope, I'll be able to use it. But it's really important to know, like, and let them know that you want to be involved in maintenance issues and dealing with the service people.
Well, about the sharing the equipment, since like at UCSF, we have a non-tradition of sharing all this heavy equipment, like centrifuges and stuff like that. And then there is like a normal situation that you know that it can ship. But then also, it's not for free. So then if you share the things, that you also need to prepare to pay for example, portion of the maintenance or something like that. So keep that in mind.
One other thing that just came to mind is the other thing, you can get a lot of free stuff. There are people who are, especially if there are people who are, say, retiring and shutting down a lab, there's a lot of basic lab equipment that you can get that they're just giving away. But also, I've had great experience. I mean, I think, I don't know how long this lasts, but probably your first few years, people are kind of invested in you and want you to succeed and want to help you and make things work. And just by discussing with people what I was purchasing or what I was thinking about buying, I had people say, oh, you know, I mean, I had one guy, oh, you know, we're not really using our FPLC much anymore. You can take our ACTA. And so I got a, you know, $70,000 piece of equipment just because I was talking to somebody about, you know, what I was thinking about buying. So people want to help, and you can get stuff if you ask for it.
Okay, so now we wanted to talk a little bit about the hardware you might need to get. This is also covered previously and will be covered in the next presentation too. But for the microscopes, if you're going to run your own cryo-EM lab, we felt that minimum requirements, if you were starting up your own, there were no microscopes there already, was that you would need an F20 or an equivalent from another company that's absolutely equipped with a direct electron detector. You don't want to start without one of those. We also felt that there... Yes? Oh, sorry. Yeah. So we also felt it's necessary to have another microscope that you can screen your samples with. Of course, you need something that you can freeze your samples with, a Vitrabot or some other plunging device, a glow discharger, carbon evaporator, and, you know, cryosample storage tanks, things like that. It also might be a reasonable idea if you're starting out and you're going with something like an F20 that you may consider asking for some resources where you can eventually send your samples to a cryos. Just let them know how much that'll save them in the long run.
Yeah, I guess a question I have for the group here is about sort of using a microscope for screening. Are people using Morganis or lower voltage microscopes for routine screening of negative stain samples and things? And what is your experience with that like? Is anybody? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so we have a Morgani. You actually can't buy them anymore, though.
Oh.
So, and we love it. So that's our screening microscope, and that allows us to actually be a very popular member of our department because it's such a robust and easy microscope to use. We can let quite a few people use it without really worrying about it affecting our work. And those microscopes don't need quite as much expense in getting the room ready, and so it's a machine that's just across the hall from the lab, and so it's very easy to run back and forth. So we use that daily.
It's also my personal kind of experience that a lot of places now wants to build the EM, and particularly when there is a major sort of user group base wants to build, and often they want to think about, okay, let's just get in a Titan Creos and everybody can use it. And it's actually depends on what you really want to train your people, because have a line of microscope from the same company and a different stage, different level, really help to training the users that so they can move on step by step. And just having a Titan, then probably you wouldn't be able to get everybody trained to really become a microscopist, and maybe they don't need to. So it's a question about how you really want to train your people. And there's another thing to keep thinking about. I think Mary will come to this point later on about how to deal with this kind of stuff.
So how many people actually are going to start a lab in, say, the next year? Up high. Or do EM. Come on, there are a few. Maybe so there's a few. And then of those, how many people are going to buy microscopes? A couple. Okay.
It was just a comment on cheap microscopes. At the LMB, we had this old Philips microscope. I don't know if it's still there, but really that was a sort of a workhorse where any student could go on that and screen his negative stain, mess up the alignment, which would make Tony Krauser very angry. And really that's where everybody could really learn how to align a microscope and understand how it works. And we can't really do that on any other higher-end microscopes, I would say.
Just to add to that, so I also love the little CM10, CM12, because they have a very poor vacuum system, so you can actually throw in grids constantly without actually worrying about it. And the other big advantage is they're very easy to use, so you can actually teach all your collaborators how to use them. So rather than you checking samples for them, they can check their own samples. They will never ever blame you again for doing a crappy job. They can just look at their own samples and have a very direct feedback. So I think these little microscopes are fantastic.
Right, and I would agree, probably because I trained with Tom and Yvonne, but we find that it's a very good screening tool, not just for our samples, but for who we want to touch our other microscopes. So if they're constantly breaking the CM10 or causing problems, then that's a red flag, and we usually make sure they're heavily supervised if they ever want to go to something bigger. And then some people just have a touch, and then you know it's going to be an easy transition.
Would anybody be able to comment on alternatives to the Titan Creos, such as the Joule 3200? Or It seems like we only hear about the Titan Krios.
Okay, it looks like a lot of people haven't used any of the geo microscope. I had a chance to use one a few weeks ago. I think it would be a good alternative. The hard part for majority of the newcomers is going to be the interface. It's more complicated. It's made for people who understand how to use it. So that's probably the really drawback. From the feedback that I learned from those who own one, it's stable, and my own observation is the same. The optics is pretty stable, so that would be an alternative. It's a lot cheaper, but there are also problems to go with it. It's not designed for automation at the moment. So you will have harder time to get that working. Hopefully we will change that when we own our own geo microscope. And so that might be something that we can do to break the monopoly, so to speak. But we'll see.
Okay, so for getting your wet lab equipment, this is completely person-dependent. It matters on what you're going to be working on, whether you're going to do mostly just microscopy, so you don't really need much of a wet lab, or if you're going to be, you know, doing culture or whatever. You should know what you need and make sure that you work closely with whoever you're negotiating with to make sure you get the resources that you need. One question that has come up and one thing we talk about is, should you try to buy equipment from places like eBay, because that can be a lot cheaper than buying something new. And I think the conclusion from the table that we were talking to was that this can work well, but you need to make sure you know you may need to be, need to be comfortable tinkering with the machinery or have someone in your lab who likes to do that, because it may not work right away. And then there is also a situation where sometimes the older equipment is actually much better made than the newer stuff that you can buy. So it's sometimes nice to get some of the older stuff that will last for longer than 5 or 6 years.
So, I mean, there's not only eBay. There are, like, biotech surplus places around. There's one in San Diego and things like that. And maybe it's sometimes they offer warranties on the equipment, that kind of thing.
I would just say, though, if it's an essential piece of equipment that is core to what you're doing in the lab, I would buy a new one. Because then you also get to establish a relationship with the vendor, more helpful when maintenance and service needs to be done on the equipment. And so if it's essential, I would buy a new one. But a lot of things, like I was saying, we've got a lot of, you know, 30-year-old Vortexes in my lab that we just picked up from other people. So.
Related to this one, equipment could be very useful. Like we have this, you said we have this very old Gateng cryo holder. It's a great tool for training people. Then you don't worry that they break it so often and that. But the service for those kind of old equipment could be tricky, because the company, the original vendor, could charge you a fortune really to get it fixed if something's broken. And then, but then there are also people that the third party sort of people doing the repair. And at least we know there's a guy in somewhere. He was a former employee for Gateng, and he fixed the holder, and then it was on a much lower price. Actually, Gateng sometimes prefer that for this kind of very old instrument that somebody else to deal with it. And then they can do a fix for you, and then with a much lower price, and do a very good job. So those are other options you can look into it.
Yeah, that guy's name is Tom Schmelter, and we recommend everybody takes their holders to him. He's great. He gives you a good deal. He's fast. You know, reasonable turnaround.
They make people a lot of old cars and old machines.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so computation will be dealt with in next session, like what you actually should buy, but we felt that when you're looking at buying individual workstations, it may be worth kind of not buying your whole computer room at once before you've even hired anybody, because the computers are going to be getting better and cheaper all the time. One thing to really consider and talk to people about is how you're going to deal with storage and make sure that you buy something that you can expand quicker than you think you're going to need to. Some institutions will have core resources and they have a vested interest in getting you to use them, but that doesn't often mean that they give you a discount. At least that's the case at Vanderbilt. That they're actually quite unreasonably priced, but you'll get a lot of pressure to participate because they've already invested so much money in it. Resist. Consider if it's not going to work for you, try to resist that and get what's going to work for you. And then, you know, make sure you have some easy access to an affordable computational cluster. And if it's not affordable, make sure that that type of money is put into your startup funds.
I can add a little bit more on this. And it's not about how to set up I think it's more like how to set up your computer environment. Like when I was in Tom's lab, and then we had a computer room. Everybody sit there doing imaging process, and I still like that kind of environment because you know you are doing image process. Somebody else is doing the same thing next in the next computer. Then people always talk to each other, and when Tom or somebody comes to sit to discuss with somebody, and everybody else in the room will join in, and they all learn from each other. And I still like this kind of environment, but then. Also, now the personal computer getting more and more powerful, and then there are more and more people just like to sitting in front of their own desk and doing the imaging process. So it's kind of different style, but I feel like in this way has reduced the level of communication even within the lab member. So it's kind of thing that to think about when you start a lab.
Yeah, so I mean, I've gone with the opposite choice to have all the workstations at people's individual desks. Mostly to facilitate people going back and forth between image processing and wet work, right? It's just more convenient that way. So, and this might be a foolish decision, but I decided to go with Macs for everybody in my lab because it's relatively easy to use all of the Linux-based stuff. It's a bit spendier, but I think the life cycle of them is a bit longer. Maybe people disagree. Yvonne's giving me a funny look. but they're solid.
Okay, so we actually wanted to spend most of the time talking about your soft resources, your time, how you're going to make your name at your institution. And so, like, how do you assess new specimens? And when we were talking to people about what they thought this meant, it often came out as, like, how do you learn to tell people, no, I can't work on this project and still have them like you? And so as cryo-EM people, you're always approached by labs wanting to use your equipment, use your time, do projects with you, and it can be challenging to figure out how to deal with this. So collaborations, of course, can be very fruitful. They can lead to new exciting areas of study. You can get new funding opportunities. They can be very exciting because it's not a project that you've been slaving on for the last 3 or 4 years. It's someone else's project. And you can become a very popular and, I think, important and essential faculty member at your institution, someone that they count on and would not like to leave, which is a good thing to be. However, they can also be quite a disaster. You can start spending so much time on other people's projects that you can't deal with your own. And that includes both your brain time and your microscope time, and also the people in your lab's time. They can't work on their own projects because they're always getting bombarded. If you're not careful, you can find yourself being treated like a core, and this can be a really bad development. And sometimes you can unexpectedly get enmeshed in really nasty politics that you weren't expecting. And then you become really unpopular very quickly. And so how to deal with these things we thought would be a good thing to talk about in the community. Anybody have any comments on this? We have some things here. So like when to say yes. I think one important thing is to always ask your question, does this fit into your scientific interest? Because if you're not interested in it at all, it's not going to help move your research forward at all. I can let you talk about that.
Just going through the ideas here. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. You want to work on things that are exciting and interesting to you so that you have the drive to push it forward. This is actually a good point. It's good to choose things where you're not going to go, especially if it's not your work, if it's a collaboration. You don't want to go head-to-head with some other group that you know is working on it unless you're a particularly competitive person. But if it's not your stuff, it might be a bad idea to get involved in that kind of thing. This one is actually a very good point. The sample already looks beautiful. That's if people have already done the legwork of getting some, you know, negative stain images, and they can show you that it's beautiful. It really lowers the bar to wanting to pursue it, right? There's something else I wanted to say.
Okay.
I forgot. And this last thing though is important, that the collaborator is going to invest effort. And I've gotten to the point where if it's not something that I really want to do myself, I sort of insist that they have a student who's willing to get trained and do the actual microscopy and the image processing, especially themselves. And this is a little hard because people don't want to listen carefully when you tell them how much work and effort it is. I mean, we all know how much time it takes to optimize the sample and then to do the processing and then to collect a new data set because you didn't get the resolution you wanted. And it's hard to, I don't know, people don't really hear it when I tell them this project's going to take your students full time for the next, you know, 6 months or a year. I think they need to believe that in order to be willing to invest the time.
It's a very, very important, tricky also situation, like Mel said. And I guess it also depends on the stage of your career in the institution. And at the beginning, you probably really want, like Mel said, focus on the things, make sure that your own research progress and you make your own identity rather than as a facility producer. And in the later stage, you know, you may also want to consider, like particularly now, this time that EM became so popular, and you also, like in our case, Dave and I, we also want our colleagues in the institution sort of to benefit from this booming, this excitement. So, but certainly we cannot accommodate everybody. We cannot help in, you know, work with every single one of them. They want to do it. And so one way we try to deal with at this stage now that we actually could possibly do is that we start providing training to a lot of labs, and then each lab providing one student. But I cannot train five students in your lab to do next stand. And I often say, okay, I can teach one person in your lab to do the next stand, and then how you use this person is not my business, right? And then you can have all your lab, you know, everybody, he became an EM person for your lab, and that's perfectly fine, but I cannot afford to train like 10 people, 5 people from your lab, but I can at least train one person from your lab if you are serious about doing this thing. So that in this way that you help them, but also they get also access to the really the latest technology. And then some project you're not interested in, but they are interested, they're exciting, you really also want to help them to train the people. But also everything take efforts from your side. So it really depends on when and what stage are you and how much efforts you want to do spend on that.
Just following up on that a bit, one good idea we had, I think it was in our discussions, was, you know, if you're a new hire, you've been hired partially because you have this cool technique and there are people in the department or the institution who want to work with you and take advantage of the fact that you have this cool new technique. So it would be a good idea to try to negotiate with the chair, whoever you're negotiating with, like a partial salary for someone who would be like a facility manager or at least facilitate for members of the department to be able to be trained, so it's not draining quite as much of your time. The bigger problem there is actually recruiting someone with those kind of skill sets is difficult. But it would be. I wish I had thought of this when I was negotiating my startup package instead of this week. But.
So, I actually did negotiate that in my startup. I have a lab manager who gets paid 25% of his salary to help people screen on the Morgani. And for that kind of position, you actually don't need someone who is a great microscopist to start with, because the Morgani is so easy to learn. You just need to find someone who's technically gifted enough and not scared of the microscope to learn. And so that's been very helpful, because what we can say is, you know, that person devotes one day of his time to have people come and bring their samples in and either get trained to use the microscope or have him look at the samples. And so we're not having people stop in the lab at all different times of the week. And that's worked very well. And we just make sure everyone knows that's our policy. If you have something new you want to look at, schedule some time with Prosh on Thursdays. You know, so, and the lab also knows not to schedule time on the microscope on that day. And so let's say you really want to do this collaboration. It's really important to have good communication, of course, with your collaborators. You want to be, you know, very upfront right from the beginning that they're not buying a resource. And that means that you're, you know, expecting to be included as an author or get on papers. And, yeah, they're not just going to give you money and you're going to do this. Depending on your situation, you may need to be very upfront about the fact that you know, if they use so much of the microscope time, you're going to expect them to help pay so much of the service contract. And remember, that's not the only thing that's actually a bargain for them, because they're not really paying part of your salary. Also, really be upfront about the limitations of the approach. So don't overpromise them things like, oh yeah, we can get a 3-angstrom structure in 2 weeks. It's better to be a little bit more on the cautious side and surprise them than be overpromise something and disappoint them. Also, it's important to clarify who's going to be responsible for who does what parts of the project. You know, are you going to train someone from their lab to do it? Are you going to do it? Who's going to do the image processing? Who's going to train them for that? And be really careful about this, because even training people to do these things can burn out a small lab. And if you're just starting out, you're likely only going to have yourself and maybe one or two other people. And it will really burn you out if you're the one that has to do this constantly and still think about what research projects you're supposed to work on and start writing your grants and all these kind of things. However, also be very careful about not minimizing your collaborator's contribution. They're not just a resource for you. You know, this sample that they've handed you likely represents, you know, 5-6 years of work to get to. And so they will get really offended if you just treat them like, you know, that they're just going to hand over a sample and you're going to take the project over. So it's really important to establish this interaction early on in the collaboration so that it's healthy as it goes forward.
The one thing I would add here is the importance of communicating with your collaborators on a regular basis. This is something I've not been terrifically great at, especially if they're not at your institution. If they're there, you see them a lot. That's one thing. But if you're not making progress on their project, or you are, it's just a good idea to be in frequent contact with people, especially because oftentimes they've made progress on the sort of experimental front that may change what you want to do, and you're struggling away with some problem that they've already solved in terms of sample prep or something. So if you engage in a sort of a long-distance collaboration, it's a really good idea to just make a point to stay in regular contact every couple of weeks or something, get in touch with them.
So here is maybe the harder part, how to say no. When to say no is when the project doesn't fit into your scientific interests. And these can be broad, but if it's something, you know, if you're a single particle person and someone wants to do tomography, it's really easy to tell them, you know, no, I don't want to do that. I can't take the time to set up all the computation and, you know, I just don't want to do that. I always say no if the collaborator won't tell me what protein complex they want to image. This has actually happened. Or they won't answer any questions about what they're trying to figure out. I'm not even polite about, I mean, I'm polite, but I don't even try to sugarcoat that. It's just an absolute no. Also, at the very beginning, as you're talking, of course, you don't want to say, okay, if I look at this sample, I demand, like, the last authorship. That will also turn them off. You don't even know what it looks like yet. But, you know, you can explain how you usually work. You know, like, we're going to collaborate on this, and usually that means whoever in my lab helps, and whatever comes out there, put on the paper, I'm also put on, you know, you kind of talk about this. It's a little uncomfortable at first until you get used to doing it. At least it was for me. But if they start kind of hemming and hawing, even at that situation, then I tell them no. Often, so I'm in the cell biology department, so I often have cell biologists show up with a purification that's really pure. It ends up being an IP that has one band on a Western blot, and they think that's pure. When that happens, it's just not appropriate, right? So you say no. And also, I have people come in, you know, wanting to look at how, like, small peptides sometimes, like, will change, you know, like, looking at things that are just way too small, like 20 kilodalms, 50 kilodalms, and I think that's the situation where you just say no.
I wonder if you guys or people in the audience have advice for how to delicately deal with the problem of you've agreed to look at a sample, somebody's got a purified protein that they're very happy with and they spent a lot of time perfecting, and it looks like, it just looks like dog shit on the grid. Like, it's just a total mess. And you want to just abandon it because it's like, or send them back to do, but people, I don't know, my experience, people are sort of, they want to believe that somewhere in that mess on the grid there's some useful information, and they want to push it. Does anybody have experience dealing with this and how to gently push people away when their sample just is no good?
Any questions, comments?
I found it's easier to sit, you know, together and then look at these images together to tell them, explain to them why this is not going to work, why they need to do something. And then I also try to think together with them, say what could potentially be wrong and where we should think from here. Because everything providing information, even the bad image, bad sample, at least tell them, you know, it's not as good as you think. But then you may be able to give them some hints or some suggestions or whatever you came into your mind that what can be done next step. And then there's always something one could be do, not necessarily on the EM side, but at least if you tell them what they should think about in the next step, and then they will be at least getting something out of it, and they will be happy. And then most time people are reasonable, they are scientists, and occasionally you run into people, you know, they say, no, everything I've done is perfect, it can only be you fucked up. So then you have to really tell them, you know, that's not the case. Right, so that things doesn't really work that way, and so there are, you know, you do have occasionally have the things like this, but the point I think is that if you are really, your attitude is try to help them solve the problem, they will be happy with you regardless of what the result is.
Yeah, I was just going to say that you know, usually we when we're looking at collaborations, the first thing you do is you look at it on a grid. It may be an IP or something like that, and it looks completely messy. But I think to go one step before that is actually really important, and just insist upon a gel filtration profile, and that, you know, if their protein has a nice single peak, you know, that's something that a lot of people can understand as being a more homogeneous sample, and you tend to have that much a little bit further ahead. And then if it's a mess, if it looks like a giant mountain range, you know, a lot of times people understand that that's a part that they need to optimize. Whereas if you look at a negative stain grid, you know, you can easily get your imagination going as that's a protein complex somewhere in there. So just doing insisting on gel filtration beforehand is, I think, pretty good.
Maybe I can also continue that. I think there's a couple other things that I always say no, and right up front. For example, if I'm already working with a lab on either internally or externally on one project, and if somebody else approaches me wants to work on the same thing, and I always say no, and I don't want to create this conflict, because you cannot work with two different labs. They are competing with each other. Then you work with both of them. Then it's going to be a disaster. It's going to be a really big mess. And I also always say no if somebody don't want to tell me, like Mel said, what is this protein? And then they sometimes say, I want you to work on this, but I cannot tell you what it is. Then I always say no. And the other thing I also say no is that if they're already working with another EM lab, and then they, you know, I do have the people approaching me, not here, but externally from other countries, that they say, oh, I was already working with this lab, but I also want to work with you to see which one goes faster. And I say, no, absolutely not. I don't want to even know. I don't want to even touch. I don't care what it is. And then there are also people approaching me say, I want to work with you, but you're in a far distance, so I will start working with the lab locally and to get somewhere, but then because they are not as good as not the, and they're busy, so once the scene's getting ready, then we will switch to work with you. Then I also say, no, if you work with them, you should respect their efforts, and then you should stick with them. And I always say no, so up front. So that's, you know, that's things that you can have a certain, so I think about it and explain them well, then they will understand you. They will not be mad or upset with you.
A short question. How do you deal actually with a crystallographer? They have a nice gel filtration peak, they have a pure protein, like pretty, really good. One would expect it crystallized. Then you put it on the negative stain grid and it looks, well, like disassembled, aggregated, whatever. And you say them to improve the protein and they just say, yeah, it's as good as it gets. It's the negative stain that destroys the protein. We should directly go to cryo.
I can add on. So sometimes this actually happens. It's not necessarily the really the protein. For example, if you want to look at the large complex, some complex, and when doing negative stain, you have to dilute your complex a lot. And then this dilution could be a problem that is making the complex falling apart. I think you need to really analyze the situation, not just tell them, say, no, this doesn't work. And then to figure out what is it. And then sometimes, yes, you know, if it really doesn't work, you can give a try to do cryo, and then may that help the problem. It's not something that, you know, we're forbidden to do. You can always do that. Even, you know, we like negative stain check first, but sometimes it's worse to actually skip it, you know, just give it a try. And crystallographers, they are usually very good in the handling their protein. They may just misunderstand the situation, and then that one, but then they are very also very reasonable. They deal with protein all the time. They oftentimes, I really respect them because they, I think they are much better in this way than I can think about it. So if you try to work with them and then try to think about together what's could be caused, and sometimes you do have we do have this situation that dilution is a major cause of a protein or something falling apart simply because it dilute thousandfold from what they made the complex. So that could be a.
So I just wanted to add a comment on the how do you let your collaborators down easy side, because as a P41 center we run into that situation very often. I'd say the most valuable thing you can have is several examples of good projects where everything, you know, has already been optimized and looks really nice, and you sit down and you show them, here, this is what your data looks like, here, this is what the data from this other project that's working looks like. And once they see that, they almost always say, oh, okay. And then they go back to the lab and they're really motivated to work on it because they don't know what to expect to see. Right, so they say, oh, I see these beautiful stuff floating around in the grid. You surely you can do something with that. But then they see this other prep, which is, you know, very pure and just looks beautiful, and they go, oh, I see. All right, I understand. So
I wanted to change the topic of discussion a little bit, and you mentioned this just in passing, but I think there's something we've all dealt with, and that is authorship issues. And you have a collaborator who comes over and has had a postdoc or graduate student working on a protein for 2 or 3 years. And you look at it and it looks great, and then, you know, it works out really well, and you solve a structure to high resolution, but then it becomes very much a structure paper as opposed to a biochemistry paper. And how do you deal with, you know, placing the person who's done the structural work and the person who's spent the 2 years, you know, building up the biochemistry to get there? When it comes time to publish. Do you have any advice on that?
No, I don't have any, I can't offer any advice on this chemistry. I think it's individually one need to deal with it. In a way, I think that if you treat the cooperation as a long-term thing, not just one shot, then everything became easier. And also your involvement is not really by the end, just, you know, I solve the structure for you this once, then you know, there may be no next time. then that's kind of thing became harder. And I typically try to avoid doing this kind of thing at all. And particularly like now, when you get really busy on the your own thing, try to avoid it. And I can help you. Your people doing the work, I can help you. I can provide my advice. I can train them. But it's your project. You drive it. And I help. But then if it's really related to your interest, you know, you get involved in the early on, and then with the biochemistry, and then it's not they say biochemistry is their job. You get involved with it, and then design the experiment, think about what to do, and then if it's a long-term collaboration, and then this authorship issue it's going to be easier to deal because you respect them, they respect you, and then this kind of mutual respect, and then you want to take care of everything. You want to present this one as a group effort, not a single person's, you know, my efforts, my glory, but it's the glory of the group. Then I think it would become easier. And then there's no, but at the end of the day, when you decide who is, there's no easy solution. But then if you think about long term, then they become, you know, this is not only paper that can come out of this collaboration. Then the things become easier. Yeah.
I just wanted to make a comment on that. So some papers now, they're not going to get published just on structure alone. And so it does take a group effort, and maybe from several groups. And I think there's a paper we're trying to put out right now, and we have three first authors, because three people put, you know, a lot of effort into it. You know, crystal structure, a lot of biochemistry, and an EM structure. And so I think it might just be more acceptable to have a few first authors, and, you know, maybe from where the project originated from should be, you know, the senior author. But it should be more acceptable now, because I really don't think not all labs are big enough to do everything. So if there's a number of people that's really contributed a lot, what is wrong with having more than one first author?
I think one thing that you can't do, though, I mean, you're right, as the project develops, things are going to change, and the focus of the work is going to change. I think it's a really bad idea to try to set up sort of who's going to be first author or last author before the collaboration begins. I think that's a really bad, because it's, first of all, it just is not nice to deal with people who are that concerned about it. But it's also, things are going to change, it's going to develop, and I think it's really hard to sort of pre-negotiate authorship positions, and you just have to be willing to negotiate that as the project develops.
I think also as a community, you know, we have to start accepting this multiple first author thing, you know, when we're hiring people, because, you know, we try and do that too, but then everyone always says, oh, we've got two first authors. Yeah, but who's first?
You know?
So it really still does count, and it shouldn't, probably.
So I have one thing to share about the collaboration. So we have one collaboration with an X-ray group. So it turned out they don't really understand which kind of sample we want. So usually for them, I don't know either from their side. Usually after gel filtration, they concentrated a large volume to a small volume, then the concentration is really high. So we have to dilute it for next stain sample. But then we told them, actually we don't need the high concentration, we don't really need a lot, we only need a tiny peak. At that time, the concentration is much better.
I just wanted to say something. One of the things about collaborations is they can often set you on new directions. So the projects that I wound up working on the longest were not projects I started, but projects that developed out of collaborations. And I must say, one of the things that I personally did is, I for those long collaborations, I did it with people I really like. So, because you spend a lot of time with them, I spent time in their labs. They spent time in my lab, and I think that's really important. And with one collaborator, Lou Tilney, that we collaborated for, I don't know, probably 30 years, we used to argue about authorship, but the reverse. Lou would always say, no, your name should go first. I would say, no, your name should go first. You did the most. So, I mean, that's a good situation to be in. So I only think, you know, science should be fun, and it shouldn't be that you're knocking your head against someone who's difficult. I would stay away from it.
We're about out of time, I think, if we want coffee. Well, no, that's it. Ask the question, whoever has that.
Actually, it's a little
it's not a question, it's a comment. I just wanted to say that try not to keep your collaboration on the PI level only, and always, at least as far as my experience as a postdoc goes, whoever is going to actually do the work, try to include them in every single step of your discussions, because otherwise it just gets out of hand.
Okay, well, thanks very much. Time for coffee break.